Chapter 12, Altamont Springs, Florida, 1995 to 2000. The day after Stan gave me the axe, I called my best friend Frank. He and his wife, Donna, were living in Florida now. After Photo World, Frank bought a franchise for a real estate title insurance agency. Eventually, he opened his own title insurance agency, Southeast Title. At the time, Southeast Title had six flourishing offices based in Longwood, Florida, 25 miles north of Orlando. As soon as I said, "Hi, Frank," he asked if Stan and I had just gotten divorced. I confirmed the worst. Without missing a beat, Frank asked me to come down to Florida. He wasn't sure how, but he would put me to work. I could depend on my best friend to come through. So, despite the vague offer of his nature, it was an offer. I took it. I moved in with Frank and his wife until I could rent a small apartment close to the office. The first few weeks on the job were shaky. Frank and I had not yet settled on a job description for me. At first, he thought I should learn everything I could about the real estate title insurance industry. That way, I could fill in statewide whenever an emergency arose. It only took a day or two to realize what a lousy strategy that was. To begin my training, Frank handed me a completed home loan closing package. I was astounded at its nearly 1-inch thickness. "Do you mean to tell me that this file is for the sale of one home?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "You're shitting me. What could it possibly contain? Why would anyone need more than 150 pages of documentation just to sell one home?" I thumbed through all the legal crapola anyway, trying to discern its meaning. I was soon more convinced than ever that learning anything about this detail-oriented, over-regulated, lawyer-banker-motivated business was a mountain way too tall for me to climb. As I got beyond my initial shock, I sat down at a desk in the middle of the office with a title insurance tutorial book, which was three times as thick as the file, and tried to make some sense of it. I immediately fell asleep. I opened my eyes to find myself staring eyeball to eyeball with Frank's wife, Donna. Donna thought that my first impression on the office staff was hilarious. Enough so to tell Frank. Mistake number one. Shortly afterward, he and I met to review my job description. Although Frank was running six successful title offices, his goal was to open eight more. It occurred to both of us that perhaps I could fit into this expansion plan, but not as a title insurance expert or real estate loan closer. It would be easier to teach me how to fly. Instead, I could be much better utilized as Frank's right-hand man and help open, furnish, and staff each new office. He also put me in charge of human resources and marketing. Now we were on to something. 2 weeks after I started working, Frank asked me to find out if the telephone company considered the distance between our office in Longwood and our other office in Claremont were considered long distance. The answer determined which piece of routing equipment we'd buy. There was a simple way to do this. Just call the phone company. Instead, I took a much faster and smarter route. I figured that since the two cities used the same area code, they'd both be considered local calls. Wrong. I was never told what the restocking fee was on that $10,000 piece of equipment we had to buy. Mistake number two. One day, Frank gave me the company's financial information to copy, take home, and read. It was only slightly less boring than a loan package. I managed to leave the original sitting on the copy machine in the middle of the office. Fortunately, Donna found them before the prying eyes of seven other employees had a chance to review them. Naturally, for my benefit and the company's, she reported this slip to Frank. Mistake number three. Frank called me into his office. We very rarely had an angry word for each other unless I did something like spilling a glass of Chardonnay on his car seat. However, I knew I was in trouble. He told me to sit down. I could tell he wasn't happy with me because I'm very perceptive. "Jim," he began, "we're not getting off to a great start. It's time to get serious. And don't start laughing." That was what I normally did in uncomfortable situations. Just ask my ex-significant others. He felt it necessary to recount my short list, but serious list, of sins. He accepted my sincere statement of intent when I said, Frank, I will get my shit together. End of conference. Up until this time, I had rarely touched a computer and had no desire to do so. I was intimidated by the learning curve. No one at Southeast Title took my Luddite attitude seriously. Donna led me to my new office and said, "There's your computer, Tidy. Sit down and pay attention." I was in the perfect place to learn. Donna agreed to train me. She still liked me, and she had mastered a number of the business software programs. "Jim," she told me, "not only is this easy, but it's almost impossible to screw things up." Ha ha. I learned quickly. From the start, I was curious about what would happen if I hit a particular key. 9 times out of 10, I found out. The computer would freeze up. Countless times I asked Donna to come to my aid. I showed her my locked-up computer with an unfamiliar but reoccurring error message plastered on the monitor. "God damn it, Tidyman, what did you do now?" "Honest to God, Donna, I was just sitting here working on this memo when all of a sudden this error message popped up." "Really?" That was my story, and I never altered it. At the time, I lived in the second-floor apartment in Altamont Springs, Florida. It was a one-bedroom, 400-square-foot man cave. I found myself saying, "Excuse me," every time I bumped into the furniture, which happened a lot. Aside from the tight living space, there was nothing special about it. About the only time I had to go up any stairs in this new Florida environment was when I went home each day to my apartment. I started to notice that I was really out of breath when I reached the second floor landing. This was not good. But it was hot. I was overweight. What's the big deal? On weekends, I would sometimes head to my favorite flea market in Daytona for a little something special that I knew I couldn't find anywhere else, like a bottle opener that activated the voices of the Three Stooges every time you opened a beer. Nyah, nyah, nyah. I particularly liked this flea market because all the food vendors there sold draft beer. I found it immensely entertaining to walk around, drink beer, and scope out all the junk. Like being in a bar, the more I drank, the better this stuff looked. I was mildly amazed the next day when I looked at the unique pieces of junk I had bought the day before. On one particular Saturday, I expected this excursion to be no different than all the rest. But by the time I started on my second beer, I noticed I was sweating profusely. It was not that warm, and no one else near me was sweating. I am a keen observer. But still, no alarms were going off. The following month, I was at an engagement party for Frank's son. The house was cool, but I felt so hot I had to sit in front of the air conditioner facing the cold blast. I ignored these symptoms for another month. In fact, I didn't even mention them to anyone. I figured if I waited long enough, they would go away. This is how most men deal with life-threatening symptoms. One week, while I was sitting at my desk composing another inspiring memo to the troops, my chest began to hurt. It was not a crippling pain, and my left arm was not tingling. I knew it was not a heart attack. Most of my medical know-how came from movies and television. Not wanting to inconvenience anyone, my usual nature, I announced that I was not feeling good and was going to see one of the McDoctors down the street. I checked in with a nurse and waited 10 minutes before I was called in. This seemed like a long time in the queue, just in case I was dying. Then again, I had ignored these symptoms for several months, so I reasoned another 5 minutes wouldn't kill me. To make a long story short, the doctor had me admitted to the nearest hospital. Tests showed I was suffering from congestive heart failure. The doctor kept me in the hospital for a few days, shot me up with diuretics, which made me pee a lot, then slapped a nitroglycerin patch on my arm, which gave me a hell of a headache, and then scheduled me for a heart catheterization. The catheterization showed that the left side of my heart was scarred and slightly enlarged. Right after he told me this, I said, "I knew it." This condition kept my heart from doing all the wonderful things it was supposed to do in its usual efficient manner, like pumping oxygenated blood throughout your system. That explained why I tired easily and sweated profusely and why my lungs would fill up with water, causing the chest pain. The doctors guessed that the scarring and enlargement were due either to an earlier bout of pneumonia or to excessive drinking. And I never had pneumonia. They started me on a series of drugs that slowed my heartbeat, lowered my blood pressure, and reduced my cholesterol. Other than telling me to watch my diet, liquid and otherwise, the doctors did not prescribe any other lifestyle changes. Would it get worse? Was I now on the short list? Only time would tell. Ha ha. Despite this little physical setback, I had a string of several good months working for Frank with no major screw-ups. I thought it was the perfect job for me. I enjoyed the specific assignments of opening offices and interviewing prospective employees. I liked traveling to new and different parts of Florida. I liked learning about the workplace laws and workers' rights. I enjoyed writing what I thought were inspiring memos. I was a legend in my own mind. The only downside was that it always seemed to be miserably hot with incessant, irritating sunshine. As HR manager, I was charged with firing employees when necessary, and it was often necessary with 14 offices and 100 employees. It didn't take long for my hatchet man reputation to take hold. Out of consideration, whenever I made a visit to an office, if I wasn't firing someone, I would let them know right away that everyone's job was safe, for now. As the owner's best friend, I had more than a little influence. In a work environment where 95% of the staff was female, you may have assumed I would wield this influence to my own advantage. I did not. Of course, I lusted in my heart for some of the female staff. However, three things held me back. First, by this point in my working life, I knew it was not the right thing to do. Second, as an HR manager who sent out more than a couple of inspiring memos regarding sexual harassment, I needed to practice what I preached. And third, I did not want to do anything to embarrass my boss and best friend, Frank. At least once a year, we had a statewide sales meeting. All the office managers, the home office support staff, and Frank and Donna attended. At this particular meeting, each manager would give a short state of their office address and tell us how they were going to increase sales in the coming year. After hearing a few enthusiastic plans, Philip, the new manager from Tampa, was up. By all accounts, his office was running well. He didn't need to say or do much. Unfortunately, invisible aliens must have tripped him into the Twilight Zone. Philip was Italian and, by most standards, good-looking. He must have read somewhere that to get the room's attention, it was always a good idea to start off with a joke. I don't disagree, but one would be wise to get a feel and understanding for the room. Philip must have missed that part in the Toastmaster's Guide to Winning Over an Audience. 80% of this audience consisted of middle-aged, college-educated, conservative women. With a big smile, Phil starts by saying, "There's this guy getting ready to go dancing." His roommate suggests that if you're going to go to a dance, the best way to attract women is to take a good-sized Idaho potato and stuff it down the front of your jeans. The room went dead silent, with shocked looks on everyone's face. Frank and I exchanged an oh-shit look, the kind that says, "Too late, we're screwed." Sensitive guy that he might have been, Philip picked up on the glacier-cold reception of his joke and said something like, "Ha! Not that good a joke anyhow." He continued by telling what he had planned for the coming year. He should have included unemployment, since I had to fire him at the end of the meeting. One afternoon, we received a registered letter from the Florida Department of Labor. We received registered letters all the time. However, the return address on this one sent shivers through the hierarchy. The letter stated that a complaint had been filed regarding the pay and salary guidelines we were using. The complaint came from a disgruntled ex-employee who had worked for us, quit, and now wanted us to rehire him, which we did not want to do. Specifically, the complaint contended that we had several salaried employees in our company when, in fact, they should have been hourly, and that he, in particular, was owed overtime. The Department of Labor thought that, by inappropriately categorizing hourly employees as salaried employees, it gave employers an unfair advantage by having these salaried employees work overtime without paying them for it. Since I was the HR guy, it was my job to serve as liaison with the representative from the Department of Labor. Before I met with this person, Frank and I really put our heads together in the office and at the bar, reading, learning about, and interpreting the guidelines for determining who is salaried, who is hourly, and the record-keeping requirement for overtime. Our learned conclusion was that we were right and that we had done nothing wrong. We verified that with our payroll provider. Then I met with the rep. I found out right away that the Department of Labor has a tremendous bias towards employees. I also found out right away that you can interpret labor laws any way you like, but in the end, it's the Department of Labor's interpretation that counts. As I explained this to Frank, he interrupted and asked, "Who's the rep?" "Her name is Rose. She doesn't seem like a very pleasant person. She never smiled, and she kept saying things like, 'Mr. Tidyman, I'm afraid that's not how we look at it.'" "What's she look like?" "Well," I said, "this may be why she's a little unpleasant. Frank, she's 5'3", red frizzy hair, and weighs in around 290. Jim, I hate to tell you this, but it looks like you're going to have to take one for the team." "Say what?" I thought that was pretty funny until Frank explained to me he was serious. He went on to say that doing whatever was necessary to get on Rose's good side might not eliminate the cash penalty completely, but it might reduce it to an amount we could live with. I had my standards, sort of. The sacrifice would have been too great. In the end, we had to change the status of 2/3 of the office staff to hourly, pay them retroactively for any overtime they claimed they worked, and pay a fine to the Department of Labor. By the time we were done, it cost us almost $25,000. Had we fought it, we would have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on attorney's fees. I heard it through the Department of Labor grapevine that we got off cheap. Who knows what we would have saved had I done my duty. By my 4th year of employment, we had met our goal of opening 14 offices. Unfortunately, the refinancing market bottomed out, the housing bubble burst, and Frank had to make some hard decisions. One evening, when Frank and I were sitting at a bar, he told me we would have to start closing the weaker offices. He assured me he could keep me busy while he downsized, but after that, he wouldn't need an HR guy or any of the other unique talents I possessed. He said that as much as he would need my help for the next 12 months, beyond that, I would no longer have a job. It wasn't that cut and dry. He danced around the subject while we split a bottle of Chardonnay or two. It's never easy to give any kind of bad news to your best friend. I understood. So while we were still sitting there, I started planning my next move. I had a year to go before I had to have another job, so looking for one was not nearly as traumatic as having to find one within a week. I also knew that Frank would make sure I landed on my feet at the end of the year. He did. By this time, I was fairly well paid and had spent it accordingly. I lived in a huge 3-bedroom duplex and leased a Nissan pickup truck. My credit cards, although not maxed out, were a bit overused. While Frank explained the sad situation of having to let me go, I thought of only one phrase, time for old Jim to minimize. Within a month, I had found a tenant to assume my lease. I moved into a much smaller apartment for half the rent and put a budget together specifically designed for reducing my credit card debt. There was nothing I could do about the leased truck. By this time in my life, I had close to 40 jobs that were vaguely chronicled on a somewhat suspicious-looking resume, or several resumes. I did not have a college degree or any high-level business management experience. Although I wore many hats at Southeast Title, Human Resources Director, Marketing and Sales Manager, and All-Around Man Friday, I was a dabbler, a dilettante. I had credible experience in retail management, but I was bone-ass tired of managing people, even though that's what I was best suited for. I did not want to stay in Florida. Who knew how much hotter global warming would make it? While still working for Frank, I took a week to drive up the East Coast to explore northern properties. I was looking for something, anything, that would make a move to Georgia, the Carolinas, or Virginia seem like a good idea. It was a wasted trip. Nothing fell out of the sky and landed in my lap. I had 10 months to go before my layoff. While thinking about all this, I wrote to my oldest brother, Robert. He was married, living in Cleveland, with 3 young sons, and had been recently diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. The thought hadn't made it into my conscious mind, but I knew that eventually he would need help. About the same restless, directionless time, I wrote a letter to a former high school sweetheart, Julie. Mentally, I must have already started to move up north. Julie lived in Mansfield, Ohio, only an hour south of Cleveland. I had run into her at our 20th reunion. I thought she looked great. By the time I wrote to her, I had been divorced from my second wife for 6 years. The commemorative book from the reunion listed Julie as unmarried. We briefly dated in high school, which is what most of us did, dated briefly. Who knows who dumped who? I was still very attracted to her. I sent her a friendly note. She wrote back. A few letters later, we started a relationship. While this relationship with Julie was developing, if only telephonically, Robert's health and marriage were failing. I had two other brothers living near him, David and John. I knew they loved our brother dearly and would do all in their power to help him. I felt the same way, but I also knew I was better equipped than they were to give him the type of help he would need. I was the handyman, cook, and task-oriented people-pleaser. In their defense, John, a writer, does not know which end of a hammer to use. David, a musician, is not quite sure what a hammer is. Julie started making trips to Florida, and we discovered that we really enjoyed each other's company. I had 3 months left at Southeast Title. While the clock ticked, my plan started to form. I decided I would move to Mansfield and find an apartment close to Julie. I would be an hour away from my brother, close enough to help him when he needed it. As for a job, how tough could it be to find work in Mansfield? At the end of my year in Florida, I took my severance pay from Frank, moved to Mansfield, and rented the top half of a quad on Julie Street. Her daughter was starting senior year in high school. That ruled out us living together. That was fine with me. The severance check from Frank gave me plenty of time to land on my feet. I rented a U-Haul truck and convinced him and his son Chip to help me load it up. Free beers always work. I hooked up my leased truck onto the car trailer, and 3 days later, Julie and I started unloading my stuff in my apartment.